My name is Timothy Vega. I want to make something clear before I begin. I'm not sharing this story as some kind of therapy or to help myself process what's happened during my time at Western Corps. I'm not trying to convince anyone to believe me or that those who don't are wrong. I'm telling this story for one reason. It's true. Every detail, every moment, it happened exactly as I'll describe it. And I've learned that truth, no matter how difficult or impossible as it may seem, is a way of becoming undeniable. And when the time comes, and it will come, accepting what's happening will be easier if you understand what's true right now. The signs are already there, just like they were back then. I understand the temptation to dismiss this as some crazy man's creepy story, but that would be a mistake. The truth is, some of you might recognize pieces of what I'm going to describe. Maybe you've seen similar things or noticed patterns that didn't quite add up. Maybe you brushed them off like I first did. What I experienced in the oil sands of northwestern Alberta in 1995 seemed incomprehensible at the time. But after over two decades, I found that trying to rationalize what's happened as anything other than reality has become more impossible than just accepting what I've seen. I know how most people view working in the oil sands, especially those who have never been near them. They think of harsh, frozen wasteland where desperate men toil in the cold dark. But at 95, landing a job up there was like winning the lottery. The pay was exceptional, more money than most 20-somethings could ever dream of making elsewhere. Sure, the conditions were brutal, 12-hour shifts and temperatures that could freeze exposed skin in minutes. 2 weeks straight of work followed by 2 weeks off, living in camp housing that felt more like a prison than a home at times. The isolation got to some people, but the numbers on those paychecks made it all worthwhile. I was one of the lucky ones. My Uncle David had put in 15 years with Western Corps Oil and Gas, working his way up from the ground up until he landed a management position overseeing operations. After I finished my 2 years at trade school in Calgary, he pulled some strings and got me in as a pump operator. Good entry-level work that matched my training. A lot of guys had to wait months or even years to get their foot in the door at places like Western Corps. But 3 weeks after graduation, I was signing my contract. 6 months of work to start with the possibility of extension, depending on how the spring thaw affected operations. The pay was more than both my parents made combined. Western Corps operated mainly in Peace River, one of the smaller oil sand deposits in northern Alberta. Nothing like the sprawling operations up in Fort McMurray or the massive developments around Cold Lake. Peace River was different, more contained, more intimate, if you could call an industrial operation that. The geography set it apart. While Fort McMurray's oil sand sat near the surface where massive shovels could dig them up directly, Peace River's deposits lay deeper underground. We had to eject steam into the wells to heat the thick bitumen until it flowed enough to pump it out. The process was slower and more methodical. The smaller scale meant fewer workers, fewer facilities. You got to know everyone's face at Peace River. At these other locations, I heard you could work there for years and still meet new people every day. The larger operations had grown into their own small cities with amenities and entertainment. But at Peace River, we just had our camp in the vast wilderness surrounding it. Everyone knew the risks. The oil sands weren't forgiving, especially back in the 90s before all of the modern safety protocols. Up in Fort McMurray, they lost people regularly. Heavy machinery accidents, toxic gas exposures, falls from scaffolding. The companies kept it quiet, but word got around. Peace River was different, though. They had their share of deaths last season, but none of them showed up in any statistics. Hard to count bodies you never find. The land around Peace River played by its own rules. The muskeg spread for miles in every direction, a deceptive landscape of wet bog that looked solid until it wasn't. One step on what seemed like firm ground could drop you into a bottomless pit of mud and rotting plant matter. Even the heaviest equipment could vanish without a trace if it strayed onto unstable ground. The dense forest surrounding the camp didn't help either. Unlike Fort McMurray with its cleared zones and developed areas, Peace River was still wild. The trees pressed in close to our operations, creating walls of darkness beyond our floodlights. During the winter nights, which was most of the time up there, you couldn't tell where the forest ended or the shadows began. There was only a couple weeks into October, my first month on the job, when I started hearing the stories and speculation about what happened to those missing individuals. Some of the more level-headed veterans, guys who had been there for years, had simple explanations. The muskeg was deep, they'd say. Others blamed the wildlife. We'd spot bear tracks in the snow near the facility, and wolves would howl in the distance during the nights. Made sense that nature took its toll. Those stories didn't bother me. My uncle had told me enough about the risks of the job to make me aware of what I was getting into. But some of them would talk about this guy, Mike Allison, a man who went missing the previous winter season. They said that Mike was a quiet guy, kept to himself, a pretty good worker, but sometimes he would complain about losing time. At first, I thought it was just a figure of speech. But the more they talked, the weirder it sounded. Apparently, Mike would sometimes miss dinner in the mess hall after his shift. And when someone would ask him where he'd been, he'd say he lost several hours between getting into his car and driving back to the camp. I hear them say it just like that, lost several hours. Pete Harrison, one of the more experienced operators, told me about something strange he'd witnessed involving Mike Ellison. He said he was driving back to the site after his 2 weeks off when he spotted what he thought was Mike's blue Ford Ranger idling on the shoulder just outside of Fairview, a town about 50 miles from Peace River. The hazards weren't on, but the headlights were burning through the night fog. During the winter months that far north, being stranded with car trouble, particularly if the motor fails, could mean freezing to death. Pete said he pulled over and got out to help. But when he walked up, the truck was empty, engine running, driver's door closed. Pete said he searched the small stand of trees next to where Mike's truck was parked, calling his name a few times. After finding nothing, he phoned the Fairview sheriff from the payphone at a nearby gas station, reported the abandoned vehicle. When Pete mentioned it to Mike the next day as shift change, Mike seemed defensive and said he had no idea what Pete was talking about. Insisted he'd driven straight through from Edmonton without stopping. I understood why someone might get defensive about memory gaps. At most sites, any sign of mental instability could get you pulled from duty, or at least demoted to some more menial position. But having dealt with our camp doctor myself, I couldn't see that being an issue at Peace River. I'd gone to see Doc Miller a couple weeks into my rotation. The constant darkness and brutal shifts had destroyed my sleep schedule. I'd lie in my bunk and stare at the ceiling for hours and then drag myself through work like a zombie. After nearly nodding off in front of the pump controls, I knew I had to get help. The medical office was just this converted trailer with fairly dirty-looking examination rooms sectioned off by curtains on wheels. Doc Miller didn't fit any image of a physician I had ever had. He lounged in a beat-up office chair, feet propped up on his desk, wearing hiking boots and a flannel under his white coat. A half-eaten sandwich sat next to the patient files. He had at least the courtesy to mute the Oilers game, which was playing on a small TV above his desk, although he seemed to do this rather reluctantly. He seemed wholly uninterested in hearing any of my symptoms beyond just trouble sleeping. Everyone has trouble in their first few months, he said. Body clock gets all screwed up from the darkness. He scribbled something on a prescription pad with the casualness of someone writing a grocery list. For what reason he actually wrote this down on a real doctor's pad, I do not know. because afterward he simply reached behind his desk and pulled out a large tub of medicine. He handed me a bottle labeled Ambien. I couldn't help but notice the bold warning label plastered across it that said, "Do not operate heavy machinery." Before I could voice any concerns, Doc Miller spoke as if reading my mind. "Take it right when your shift ends. Gives it enough time to wear off before you're back on duty." You reached for the TV remote and unmuted it. The subtle click of volume and the returning commentary of the game made it clear that our consultation was over. The moment I got back to my room that night, I swallowed one of the pills with a glass of water. People love to complain about the living conditions up at Peace River, but I've never found them as bad as I've made them out to be. Western Corps actually provided private rooms for each of the workers, something I learned wasn't standard across all sites. Sure, my room was barely bigger than a prison cell, with just enough space for a twin bed and a small dresser, but at least it was mine. I went through my usual routine that night, a hot shower to wash off the day's grime and a microwave dinner while watching fuzzy reruns of MASH in the common room. By the time I finished eating, I could feel a pleasant heaviness settling into my limbs. Thought maybe these pills would actually help. My eyelids grew heavier as I changed into my sleepwear, and for the first time since arriving at Peace River, I felt genuinely ready for sleep. Just when I was about to get into bed, a shadow filled my doorway. Joe Stanson, our team lead for pump operations, stood there like a mountain in his coveralls. His massive frame barely fit to the narrow entrance, and his patchy beard caught the hallway's fluorescent light. He was the kind of man whose presence demanded attention, not just from his intimidating size, but from the way he carried himself. The man had worked at Peace River for over a decade, and everyone knew crossing him meant dealing with the worst assignments and schedules imaginable. I tried to focus on what he was saying about the next day's work schedule and some kind of delay, but the Ambien was already taking hold. Medication hit me like a wave, making the edges of reality soft and indistinct. Joe's words started to blur together, his bulky silhouette seeming to sway in my doorframe as my mind drifted between consciousness and sleep. I caught fragments about the equipment checks and schedule changes, but the details slipped away as quickly as they came. I remembered nodding along, hoping I was making the right responses at the right moments. I must have performed this act well enough because eventually he turned and left. After Joe left my room, I fell into my bed, craving sleep like never before. The Ambien had been on my limbs, and the waves of fatigue washed over me, promising rest. It should have come easily. Throughout the night, I laid awake, staring at the ceiling. The only illumination in my room was the thin sliver of moonlight forcing its way through the small window. In those moments of wakefulness, I found my thoughts drifting between my friends back home and the tasks that waited for me the next day. The silence of the room was only broken by the strange noises that plagued our camp after dark. The distant blasts of compressor release, the groaning of frozen metal, even an occasional howl of a wolf far off in the woods. But there were stretches of time that I could hardly account for, points where exhaustion must have claimed me, although I hadn't felt like I was asleep. But after checking the clock, a significant amount of time would have passed. During these periods, I would become aware of the cold seeping through the thin walls and poorly insulated window. I'd breath fogging slightly in front of me. These states depressingly repeated throughout the night, a weary cycle of waking and half asleep, accepted periodically by strange convexes of black emptiness of which I have no recollection. I do remember someone appearing in my doorway. The man was hulking, the same size as Joe Stanson. He filled the entire frame, casting a silhouette so massive it couldn't have been anyone else. My heartbeat quickened as I waited for him to speak, wondering if he was there to give me some early wake-up time or tell me about change of plans. But he didn't say a word. For several long seconds, he just stood there. I couldn't make out his face in the darkness, only the broad outline of his shoulders and the way he leaned slightly against the doorframe. My room was too dark to know if he realized I was awake and was looking right at him. A Afraid to move, I glanced at the clock in my nightstand without turning my head. 2:48 a.m. The stillness became unbearable. I stared at the figure, waiting for any sign of movement or speech, but he remained completely motionless, like a statue carved from shadows themselves. His presence seemed to grow as the seconds slipped by, a darkness within the darkness spilling into the room. I tried to tell myself it was Joe, that he had some reason for this bizarre visit, but the longer I stared, the less it looked like him. The figure's edges seemed to blur and shift, leading into the black of the room. Its shape grew less defined, as if my eyes were playing tricks on me, feeling in spaces that weren't there. After several minutes of feeling so paralyzed that I barely dared to move my eyes, I looked back at the clock again. That same mocking time stared back at me, 2:48 a.m. Surely several minutes had passed, but there was no movement, no progression of time. Just that unchanging glow, as if the clock had frozen along with the figure in my doorway. The longer I watched, the more the two seemed intertwined. The figure's unsettling stillness and the clock's refusal to tick forward. Each second I crawled by turned my unease into a gnawing sense of dread. I fought the urge to speak, to ask this motionless stranger what it wanted. My instincts told me that if I broke the silence, there was no going back. The moment I acknowledged it, this presence would cross some invisible threshold and step fully into my reality. The air in my room seemed to grow colder, as if the temperature had plummeted since the figure appeared. A primal urge tugged at me to close my eyes and to pretend to be asleep, to escape this oppressive presence that radiated an unseen malevolence. But I remained paralyzed with eyes open, suspended between fight and flight, my muscles refusing to obey as my heart pounded against my chest with a growing intensity. The stillness stretched on as I strained my eyes against the darkness, trying to make sense of the shape before me. But the more I looked, the more it seemed to change, its edges dissolving like mist. I kept my eyes fixed on the clock, almost willing the glowing red digits to change. I tried to pinch myself to see if I was somehow dreaming, but my body refused. I began to silently panic as I realized I might not be able to move, even if I wanted to. Then, finally, the digital display flickered. 2:55 a.m. 7 minutes had vanished. I snapped my gaze back to the doorway. Empty. The hulking silhouette was gone, leaving only the faint glow of the hallway light spilling into my room. The rest of the night I stayed awake with the lights on and the chair jammed under the doorknob. The ambient haze had worn off, replaced by a raw, wired alertness. Every creak of the building, every gust of wind rattling the window pane, sent a jolt through me. I sat on the edge of the bed, staring at the door, waiting for the figure to reappear. It never did. But the feeling of being watched lingered, clinging to me like the cold dampness that permeated the room. I didn't even realize it was morning until the sounds of others getting ready for the day started filtering in from the hallway. The ordinary sounds of clanging locker doors and muffled conversations were the only thing that finally gave me the courage to open the door. The morning briefing took place while it was still dark outside, in the same weathered trailer where all our shifts began. The room smelled of coffee and damp winter clothes, and water stains marked the ceiling tiles where snow had melted through during previous winters. The trailer's thin walls did little to keep out the bitter Alberta cold. 15 of us huddled near the front where Joe Stanson stood with his clipboard next to a space heater. I studied Joe carefully as he announced the day's assignments. His round face, the stocky shoulders, the way he seemed to lean to the right when he stood. I tried to match these details with the figure from my doorway, but the memory of that presence felt altogether different, like comparing a photograph to a shadow. Joe's voice carried its usual authoritative tone as he outlined the day's objectives, checking off items on his list as he went. Nothing in his manner suggested anything unusual had happened. He didn't glance my way any more or less than usual. However, when he announced my assignment to monitor the furthest pump stations out at the edge of our operation, I had to stop myself from physically grimacing. This meant a 15-minute walk through the pre-dawn darkness and biting wind to reach my post. I'd be adjusting the steam injection rates and optimizing flow volumes near where the forest edge met our operation. It was far from an ideal assignment. Part of me wondered if this was somehow a punishment connected to last night's incident. But even as the thought formed, I knew it made no sense. The schedule was likely set days in advance, just another routine rotation of duties. When Joe finally finished, I began my trudge through the outer edge of the operation. The only sound was a low hum of distant machinery and the occasional groan of the metal pipelines contracting in the cold. Out here, away from the main camp, it was easy to feel utterly alone. I tried to focus and think about the task ahead, checking gauges, adjusting valves, the routine mechanics of my job. But my mind kept wandering back to the figure in my doorway and how the Ambien hadn't helped, not really. They hadn't dragged me down into the heavy, dream-filled sleep I'd hoped for. I began to wonder if this was some sort of hallucination, maybe some sort of side effects of the medication. A couple days earlier, during a lunch break, someone had mentioned Doc Miller had a history of using hypnosis to help guys with sleep problems or stress. I thought it was a joke at first, but they said it worked like a charm. But the idea of hypnosis, it never sat right with me. It felt like handing over the keys to your mind, letting someone else rummage around in your thoughts. Especially someone like Doc Miller, who seemed more interested in getting you back to work than actually figuring out what was wrong. I will admit that my views on his practice are clouded from my own experiences. I myself have never been hypnotized, but I did witness my sister's desperate attempt to lose weight through hypnotherapy 3 years earlier. She had had weight problems since early childhood, and it really began to weigh on her mentally. And although I don't think she ever really gave normal solutions like diet or exercise a shot, I didn't see how this could hurt. She dragged me along to the first session, insisting she needed moral support. The office had reeked of incense and hardly resembled anything close to an established medical practice I recognized. They placed a table laden with fatty foods, fried chicken, greasy pizza, all the stuff she was supposed to be avoiding right in front of her. After putting her under, or whatever the technical term is for such an act, the hypnotist started suggesting, in his soothing voice, that she didn't want any of it, that the sight of it repulsed her. He suggested that the very thought of eating this food was akin to setting her hand on a hot stove. My sister, still in her trance, reached for the chicken. She picked up a piece, stared at it blankly for a moment, and then tore into it. It wasn't just eating, there was something feral, like something a starved animal would do, let loose on a carcass. She grabbed slice after slice of pizza, shoving it into her mouth so fast she could barely chew. The sound she made, a mixture of choking and gagging, almost made me laugh. Seeing this pseudoscience fail right in front of me was rather amusing at first. Yet as she kept reaching for more, her eyes glazed over and it started to seem more serious. The hypnotist, I could tell, started to panic. The soothing tone cracked and was replaced by a sharper, more urgent voice. He repeated his earlier suggestions, louder this time, as if sheer volume could break through whatever hold he'd placed on her. But she just kept eating. At one point, she even bit into her own fingers, hard enough to draw blood. Yet she continued oblivious to the pain. He tried snapping his fingers in her face, but it had no effect. My sister just kept eating like a wild animal. Finally, he resorted just to shaking her, hard. Her head lolled back and forth until she finally woke up. She apparently had no recollection of what had happened. Despite the absurdity of what had occurred in that office, the results were undeniable. My sister never touched fried food again. Within weeks, she'd lost so much weight, she looked like a different person. By month's end, she subsisted almost entirely on raw vegetables. It was like someone had flipped a switch in her brain. No amount of coaxing could even get her to look at a piece of pizza. For most of the morning as I worked, I wrestled with the idea of going back to Dr. Miller and giving myself over to hypnosis. The more logical side of my brain would have almost never given in to something like this. But the fatigue I felt that day put me in a state where any idea was on the table. But by 11 a.m., full daylight finally returned, and so did my better judgment. I decided that I would at least try the medication for a few more nights, before I became desperate enough to go back to Doc Miller. I spent the bulk of the midday and afternoon holed up in the small pump operator's cabin. It was a cramped metal box barely big enough to turn around in. This task mostly consisted of monitoring gauges, adjusting flow rates, and logging the data. A repetitive cycle punctuated by the occasional need to climb out and heat up a frozen valve. The cabin itself had its own small heater, the windows frosted over if I ever left it running too long, coating the glass with a thick layer of condensation that obscured the view of the surrounding infrastructure. This would force me to wipe the windows periodically with my sleeve to maintain visibility of the equipment. During one such clearing, I noticed movement at the tree line about 250 yards from my position. I pressed my face closer to the glass, squinting through the patches I'd cleared. Three figures, which appeared to be children, stood at the edge of the forest. They couldn't have been more than 3, maybe 3.5 feet tall. They seemed to mill about aimlessly, not really walking anywhere specific, just shifting their positions around slightly. I studied the children more intently. Despite the distance, something about their proportions seemed wrong. Their heads appeared too large for their bodies, almost cartoonish in size. Each wore what looked like identical gray clothing, coats, pants, and what I assumed were winter hats, though from this far away, they blended together into gray uniform shapes against the white snow. The sight in front of me made no logical sense. This section of the operation was at least 30 miles from the nearest town. There were no homes out here, no schools, nothing but industrial equipment and wilderness for miles in every direction. Even if there had been houses nearby, no parent would let their children wander onto an active oil extraction site. I felt my heart rate quicken, though I couldn't explain why. They were just kids. Maybe one of the workers had bought them for some reason. But something about their stillness, the way they moved without really moving, sent a chill through me. I cursed myself, remembering that I'd left the radio in the storage shack when I'd gone to get the heating torch earlier. I should have reported this immediately. Children on site was a serious safety issue. But now I'd have to leave my heated cabin and walk across the exposed compound to retrieve it. The logical part of my brain told me that these were just wayward kids who needed to be escorted off the property. But a deeper, more primitive part screamed that something was deeply wrong about what I was seeing. I remained frozen in place, unable to look away from their gray forms as they continued their strange, aimless movements at the tree line. I kept watching them through the cleared patch on the window, my breath creating new frost around the edges. Something about their presence made my skin crawl. They remained eerily still for several more minutes, like decorations someone had placed on the tree line, until suddenly, as if responding to some unseen signal, they all turned toward my cabin in perfect unison. They began walking in my direction. Even from the distance, their movements were wrong. Their arms didn't swing naturally at their sides. They hung stiffly like broken pendulums. And despite the deep snow that should have made walking difficult for children their size, they moved at a steady, unchanging pace. My hands were shaking as I grabbed the heating torch I'd used earlier on the valves. Its weight was reassuring, though the rational part of my brain screamed at how absurd this was. They were just kids, probably lost or playing where they shouldn't be. But watching their synchronized approach, the way their oversized heads remained perfectly still while their bodies moved beneath them, I couldn't shake the feeling that whatever was walking towards me wasn't children at all. Once they drew within 50 yards, I made my final horrifying observation. They weren't dressed in gray coats, pants, and hats. Their skin was gray, and their eyes, Their eyes were large and black, reflecting the swirling snow like bottomless pits. I yanked the cabin door open and bolted into the snow, dropping the torch somewhere behind me. The freezing air burned my lungs as I ran, my boots kicking up powder as I went. I'd always considered myself in decent shape, but now I ran with a speed I didn't know I possessed. My heart hammered against my ribs as I sprinted back towards the main compound, not daring to look back. I don't remember much about my sprint back to the compound. The world had narrowed to the crunch of snow under my boots and the burning in my chest. When I finally burst through the medical building's door, my clothes were soaked with sweat despite the freezing temperature. Doc Miller spent the next 2 hours trying to calm me down in his office. My hands wouldn't stop shaking as I described what I had seen at the pump station. He listened patiently, taking notes and nodding. The office's familiar antiseptic smell and the warmth gradually brought me back to reality. He explained that hallucinations were a known side effect of Ambien, especially when combined with sleep deprivation. The past few weeks of poor sleep had likely created the perfect conditions for vivid waking dreams. The gray figures, he suggested, were probably shadows or equipment that my exhausted mind had transformed into something more sinister. Doc Miller pulled out his prescription pad and wrote me a script for something called Sonata. He described it as a gentler alternative to Ambien, less likely to cause such intense side effects. Medication would help establish a normal sleep pattern without the risk of hallucinations or sleepwalking. He once again filled the prescription himself, pulling the large tub of medicine out from behind him. I clutched the new bottle of pills in my pocket as I left his office, holding onto it like an anchor to reality. The logical part of my brain accepted his explanation. Stress, exhaustion, and strong medication had created a perfect storm of delusion. But deep down, a voice whispered that what I had seen had been too specific, too detailed to be a mere hallucination. The next few weeks blurred together in a haze of fitful sleep and long shifts. The Sonata helped somewhat. I'd drift off faster, but never really reached that deep, restful state I desperately needed. Dark circles formed under my eyes, my hands developed a slight tremor that made recording pressure gauge readings more difficult than it should have been. Doc Miller checked in on me occasionally, always focusing our conversations on sleep patterns and medication adjustments. Not once did he mention my experience at the pump station, treating it like a closed chapter. At least Joe Stanson kept me close to the main compound. My duties shifted to monitoring the central processing facility, where I tracked pipeline pressures and adjusted flow rates from a warm control room. The work was monotonous but demanding. One wrong adjustment could shut down the production for hours. Steam hissed through the pipes overhead as I made my rounds. The sound became a constant companion during those long December nights. The cold intensified as winter dug in its claws. Temperatures plummeted to minus 40, cold enough that the metal handrails would steal skin from bare hands. Ice formed in the poorly insulated sections of the pipeline, requiring constant attention to prevent blockages. We worked in pairs now, checking each other for signs of frostbite during outdoor maintenance rounds. The darkness seemed to stretch longer each day. By mid-December, we'd see only a few hours of gray twilight between sunrise and sunset. The facility's floodlights cast harsh shadows across the snow, creating strange patterns that I forced myself not to study too closely. I kept my eyes on my gauges, my logbooks, my control panels, anywhere but the darkness beyond the fence line. The holiday break came as a relief. Most workers headed home to their families, leaving the facility operating on a skeleton crew. I spent Christmas in Calgary with my parents, trying to forget about Western Corps. But January brought us all back to the bitter cold and endless darkness of Peace River. I woke up on January 8th to something wet on my face. A metallic taste hit me before I opened my eyes. When I did, I froze. Blood covered my sheets, dark crimson stains spreading across the white fabric. But what made my heart really stop was the walls. Blood marked them in long streaks, as if someone had painted them with my blood as I slept. My first coherent thought was that I must have been attacked. I jumped out of bed, checking myself for injuries. That's when I felt it, a dull ache in my sinuses, the kind that comes after a nosebleed. I rushed to the mirror. Dry blood caked my nostril and upper lip, trailing down my neck. I'd had nosebleeds before, but never produced this much blood. Never enough to soak through the sheets, never enough to somehow reach the walls that were feet away from my bed. I stripped the bed, bundling the sheets into a tight ball. My hands shook as I tried to clean the walls, watching red-tinged water run down the cheap wallpaper. No matter how I tried to rationalize it, one thought kept swirling back, that this wasn't just a nosebleed. This was something else entirely. I arrived in the pre-dawn darkness to Doc Miller's trailer. I perched on the edge of the paper-covered table while he peered up my nostrils with his otoscope. My hands wouldn't stop trembling as I described the blood-soaked sheets and the strange amount of blood at my walls. The memory of waking up covered in my own blood made my stomach turn. He clicked off the light and stepped back, writing something in my file. The scratching of his pen filled the silence as I waited for his verdict. According to him, nosebleeds can produce an alarming amount of blood, far more than most people realize. He pointed out some raw patches inside my nasal cavity, suggesting that I might have scratched myself during sleep. I stared at the floor, exhausted. More sleep problems. More explanations that almost made sense, but felt wrong. The fluorescent lights hummed above Doc Miller as he prepared another prescription. I fought the urge to scream. I was tired of medications, tired of waking up confused, tired of being told everything had a rational explanation where nothing felt rational anymore. My head throbbed as I thought about returning to my blood-stained room. I watched Doc Miller tuck the prescription pad back into his coat pocket, studying my face. Something in my expression must have betrayed my reluctance. He pulled his chair closer, the metal legs scraping against the linoleum floor. The word hypnosis made my skin crawl when he first suggested it. Images of swinging pocket watches and circus performers filled my mind. But as he explained the process, a simple relaxation technique that it was used to access memories and resolve sleep disturbances, it all started to sound a little less ridiculous. According to him, several workers at Western Corps had undergone hypnotherapy successfully. Sleep problems weren't uncommon in the isolation of the oil fields, especially during the dark winter months. My fingers traced the dried blood still caught under my fingernails. More pills meant more potential side effects, more confusion, and more lost time. At least hypnosis was non-chemical. I nodded slowly, agreeing to try it. Doc Miller seemed pleased. He gestured toward the worn leather couch against his office wall. The cushions exhaled as I lowered myself down. The ceiling tiles above formed a grid pattern that my eyes traced while he dimmed the fluorescent lights. He pulled his chair next to the couch, close enough that I could smell the coffee on his breath. A small cassette recorder was in his hand. He clicked to start it and set it on a nearby metal desk. The quiet hum of the heating system filled the room. His voice took on a different quality, softer, measured, almost melodic. Following his instructions, I focused on my breathing while he counted backward. The tension on my shoulders began to fade. My eyelids grew heavy as he described his instructions. The office seemed to recede, becoming less substantial with each breath. Doc Miller's voice grew distant, as if traveling through water to reach me. My limbs felt weighted, impossible to move. Even keeping my eyes open required too much effort. Time began to lose meaning. I floated in that strange space between sleeping and waking, yet I was aware of Doc Miller's voice. Through my half-closed eyelids, the ceiling tiles appeared to shift and ripple. His voice continued its steady rhythm, guiding me deeper into whatever state I was entering. He then began to guide me back to the previous night. The transition felt seamless. One moment I lay in his office couch, the next I found myself in my bed. "Tell me what you're experiencing, Timmy." Doc Naylor's voice came from somewhere far away. My mouth felt dry as I responded. "I'm in my bed. It's dark. The emergency light from the hallway comes through the gap under my door." The scene felt more vivid with each detail I shared. The heating system, it's making that clicking sound it always does. But something's wrong. I can't move. My limbs were lead weights sunk into the mattress. Even turning my head seemed impossible. The paralysis wasn't painful, just absolute. My eyes darted around the room, the only part of me that could still move freely. "I'm awake. I know I'm awake, but I can't lift a finger." The clock in my nightstand says 2:47 a.m. The red numbers are the only light besides what's coming under my door. Doc Miller's distant voice soothed my rising panic. "You're safe, Tinny. This is just a memory. Just the hypnosis. Nothing can harm you here." My chest loosened slightly. The paralysis didn't feel as threatening when I remembered I was actually lying at his office couch. "I want to teach you something that will help you sleep," Doc Miller said. "A technique that you can use whenever you need it. Start counting backward from 10. When you reach 3, begin again at 10. This will train your mind to drift off naturally." I started counting. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. The numbers felt thick on my tongue. I started over. 10, 9, 8, 7. The repetition was oddly soothing. My line began to float. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. A scraping sound cut through my counting. The window across from my bed slid sideways, the metal frame grinding against itself as it opened. Cold air rushed in, carrying snow flurries that danced in the dim red glow of my alarm clock. My heart hammered against my ribs. "What do you see, Timmy?" Doc Noor's voice sounded like it was coming from 1,000 miles away. My throat constricted as I watched the window slide fully opened. Something's coming in. Something's coming in through the window. A gray hand, too long and too thin to be human, gripped the windowsill. The fingers had an extra joint, bending in ways that made my stomach turn. The creature pulled itself through with an unnatural fluidity. Its movements reminded me that of a spider. Its head barely cleared the frame. It had to be at least 7 feet tall. The skin was gray, gray like wet clay left in the sun too long. It's not human, I choked out. Its head is wrong. It's too big. The eyes are just black. Two smaller figures followed, climbing through with the same disturbing grace. Their proportions matched the ones I'd seen at the pump station. Child-sized, but wrong in every way. "No, no. No, this can't be real." My voice cracked. They're standing by my bed now, just watching me. "Could it be someone from the camp?" Doc Miller asked. His tone was too calm. "Perhaps workers in protective gear." "These aren't people," I whispered. "Their joints bend backwards, their fingers. Their fingers are twice as long as they should be. The big one's head nearly touches my ceiling." The tall creature tilted its head, studying me with those bottomless black eyes. No protective ear could explain what I was seeing. No mask could capture that face, those impossible proportions. I wanted to scream, to thrash against the paralysis holding me down, but my body remained frozen under their gaze. The smaller figure suddenly held a metallic case I hadn't noticed before. They're opening something, I managed to say through frozen lips. "That sounds perfectly normal, Timothy. Just relax and observe. Doc Mota's voice drifted through my consciousness. Normal? How can you say this is normal? The words came out as a desperate wheeze. My paralyzed body wouldn't even let me shake my head in denial. The case opened with a soft click that seemed to echo in my skull. The smaller beings withdrew objects that gleamed in the dim red light of my alarm clock. Delicate instruments that reminded me of surgical tools, but somehow wrong, like everything about them. Their movements were precise and mechanical as they passed each instrument to the tall figure. I can see there's something at the tip of one of those tools. My voice trembled. I could see a tiny metal bead catching the light. Remember, Timmy, you're completely safe. This is a normal procedure. Normal? This isn't normal. I want to wake up now. Panic clawed at my throat. I want to wake up now. The tall figure leaned over my bed, that impossibly large head blocking out the light from my window. The tool with the metallic bead moved closer to my face. I want to wake up now. I want to wake up now. I want to wake up now. Remain calm, Timmy. The procedure is almost complete. Doth Miller's voice drifted through my consciousness with an unsettling serenity. The creature towered over me, its spindly fingers positioning the metallic instrument with a practiced precision. The smaller beings stood motionless, watching with those obsidian eyes. I wanted to protest, but the words died in my throat as the device pressed against my nostril. A sharp pain shot through my sinuses as the metal bead traveled upward. My body convulsed against the paralysis, managing only slight tremors as the foreign object pushed deeper. The sensation was beyond description, like something crawling through my skull, burrowing towards my brain. The pressure built until I thought my head would split open. The bead reached its final destination with a click that I felt rather than heard. The tall figure withdrew the instrument with that same mechanical grace. Wake up now, Timmy. My eyes snapped open. I sat upright on Doc Miller's couch, hands clutching my face. My sinuses throbbed with a deep, penetrating ache. Something warm trickled from my nose, blood dripping under my shirt. How are you feeling? Doc Miller asked. I looked up at him, ready to scream, to demand answers. The words died in my throat. Where there should have been concerned brown eyes, behind those wire-rimmed glasses, I saw only darkness, bottomless black pools staring back at me. I left Western Corps that night, left Alberta, left Canada entirely. 28 years in the United States now, and I've undergone every medical procedure imaginable. MRIs, CT scans, even experimental imaging techniques. Doctors found nothing, despite the blood that still occasionally drips from my nose. You probably think you know how this story ends. Another unsolved mystery, another unexplained encounter, but you're wrong. I knew they would return, and I prepared. Every night for 28 years, I slept in the same room, a room with a single window. I rigged that window with antique World War II Claymore mines I was able to acquire online from a war collector. Bear traps lined the floor beneath. I waited, night after night, year after year. They came back 3 months ago. The explosion took out the entire side of my house. I even got some shrapnel in my own leg. Their bodies are in my basement now. Three of them, preserved in industrial freezers. I searched day after day for any kind of craft that they may have arrived in, but I haven't found it yet. I don't expect anyone to believe me, but I know it's in my basement. I know what they put in my head, and I know they won't be the last.